No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I am not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me. There are moments, most unexpectedly, when something inside me tries to assure me that I don't really mind so much. Not so very much, after all. Love is not the whole of a man's life. I was happy before I ever met H. I've plenty of what are called resources. People get over these things. Come, I shan't do so badly. One is ashamed to listen to this voice, but it seems for a little to be making out a good case. Then comes a sudden jab of red-hot memory, and all this common sense vanishes like an ant in the mouth of a furnace. On the rebound, one passes into tears and pathos. Maudlin tears. I almost prefer the moments of agony. These are at least clean and honest. But the bath of self-pity, the wallow, the loathsome, sticky, sweet pleasure of indulging in it, that disgusts me. And even while I'm doing it, I know it leads me to misrepresent H herself. Give that mood its head, and in a few minutes I shall have substituted for the real woman a mere doll to be blubbered over. Thank God the memory of her is still too strong. Will it always be too strong to let me get away with it? For H wasn't like that at all. Her mind was lithe and quick and muscular as a leopard. Passion, tenderness and pain were all equally unable to disarm it. It scented the first whiff of cant or slush, then sprang and knocked you over before you knew what was happening. How many of my bubbles she pricked. I soon learned not to talk rot to her unless I did it for the sheer pleasure. And there's another red-hot jab of being exposed and laughed at. I was never less silly than as H's lover. And no one ever told me about the laziness of grief, except at my job, where the machine seems to run on much as usual. I loathe the slightest effort. Not only writing, but even reading a letter is too much, even shaving. What does it matter now whether my cheek is rough or smooth? They say an unhappy man wants distractions, something to take him out of himself. Only as a dog-tired man wants an extra blanket on a cold night. He'd rather lie there shivering than get up and find one. It's easy to see why the lonely become untidy, finally dirty and disgusting. Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. Those were the opening two pages of A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis. My mother passed away on the 5th of December, a year ago tomorrow, from pancreatic cancer. And some of the resultant, the aftercare part of that, I guess, of the aftercare was... just some perfunctory literature, leaflets, appropriately quite a clinical service, really. Just glib leaflets about bereavement and what you can, bullet-pointed, very prosaic literature, just said, Oh, you know, stay active, talk, open up to people, the common sense kind of things that you pay no attention to, I find. And in the back of this leaflet was a list of recommended books. And one of which was this one, and this is the only one I bothered to pick up. One, because I am already interested in C.S. Lewis, the Christian apologist C.S. Lewis, not the author of, you know, kind of fantasy fiction. I dipped into a book called The Problem with Pain prior to this, so I thought, well, I've turned to books at dark times plenty enough in my life, so what have I got to lose? Might as well, if I was going to heed anything out of this pamphlet, it might as well be picking up a snazzy wee book. So I did. So it's a very short book, but one of the deepest, most insightful works I've ever read. I've just reread it there prior to going live on the podcast. Because I've wanted to do this podcast for some time, and I've had it in the back of my mind to go back to this, because there's certain things have stayed with me in the last year from this book that I'm sure I will never ever forget. One of which is this idea that he discusses here. He says, cancer and cancer and cancer. My mother, my father, my wife. I wonder who was next in the queue. Yet H herself, dying of it and well knowing the facts, said that she had lost a great deal of her old horror at it. When the reality came, the name and the idea were in some degree disarmed, and up to a point I very nearly understood. Yeah, having read that after the turmoil of living with a terminally ill parent, I immediately, that's within the first sort of 10 pages, it just fell on me like a ton of bricks, really, that how well Lewis articulates these feelings, these intangible emotions, which is very difficult to do, especially with something as heavy as loss, as bereavement. These abstractions he deals with very well. And the idea that the reality quells the horror, the idea that you can relinquish that fear by, and this is quite an old, maybe a cliche, but there's one of my favourite clichés that I think I invented, at least I take credit for it, as I do many things that probably aren't my construct. One of my favourites is, yeah, there's a reason it's a cliché. Clichés are there because they're good, aren't they? They're good sayings. There's a reason that they are repeated ad infinitum. But yeah, the idea that once you face the reality, it's maybe not as bad as what you make out, and that, and he goes on to say that the stresses the importance of all this. He says, one never meets just cancer or war or unhappiness or happiness. One only meets each hour or moment that comes, all manner of ups and downs, many bad spots in our best times, many good ones in our worst. One never gets the total impact of what we call the thing itself. But we call it wrongly. The thing itself is simply all these ups and downs. The rest is a name or an idea. One of the most profound excerpts of writing I think I've ever laid eyes upon. I've spent quite a lot of time with this, just mulling this over. You know, previous podcasts talk about depression as well. So that, you know, the pursuit of happiness, what that means. You know, the happiness being again an abstraction. It's treated as a destination that you can arrive at and remain at, and that's what we're all questing. And I guess ultimately, one of the lessons learnt from through all of this, through grief, is that's just not how it works. These things are not just concrete. They're not concrete. They are states to be not so much holidayed at, experienced, but not exclusive of everything else. You can still meet happiness whilst swimming in a lot of unhappiness. Everything is, it's all the in between, the moments between the thing, life itself. That's the thing itself. So as with cancer, you're not just dealing with the big C, you know, with the C word. You can still deal in happiness. I still had some, probably the happiest, ironically, moments with my mother inside the months when she was dying. That we certainly more happy than we'd had in our lifetime, our respective lifetimes. Together, that is, as a mother and son. And that was, you know, that didn't last forever. We just paid a visit to that happiness. And ultimately, we're not just dealing with one abstraction at a time, and we're not just dealing with one concrete notion at a time. It's all interlaced, and there's still hope for experience of all these other facets simultaneously. You're not just, when I'm depressed, I'm not just depressed, I'm not just unhappy, I'm still able to experience moments of happiness. I can still visit at happiness, which I guess is what, where the struggle lies with the stigma of depression. You've got to play the patient role or the sick role, and you're expected by the status quo to just be down or incapable of, sort of, if you can't attend work, for instance, because of depression, then you seem not to be able to attend to most things in your life. You've almost got to lock yourself away and just rock back and forth in unhappiness. You are able to experience multiple emotions in your life, and that's fine. And that's something, perhaps, maybe I didn't learn through all this, but was definitely reinforced when reading Lewis's account of that. And I think that is very deeply profound. I mean, then there's all the other matters Lewis covers. I guess the relationship of the grieving, the bereaved, with everyone around them, the almost aversion therapy that is, no, the avoidance, sorry, of friends or people who know you because you're a cause of embarrassment or awkwardness. There's an elephant in the room. We can't discuss, you know, when do we mention the loss, sort of thing. That's explored quite well. And he's very, very honest, I guess. And there's a nice term I just want to reference here. I watched a great documentary on YouTube last night about Albert Camus, called The Madness of Sincerity, which is what I'm almost obsessed with in this part of my life. The idea of sincerity taking precedence over everything. And I think what I'm trying to achieve with these podcasts is something that Lewis certainly lays down the blueprint for in this book. I mean, even in the second chapter, after he's written almost 20 pages of really insightful, profound beauty, the opening of the second chapter is, for the first time I've looked back and read those notes, they appall me. From the way I've been talking, anyone would think that H's death mattered chiefly for its effect on myself. He's completely relentless in his self-assessment, in his awareness of the whole thing. And I don't want to make this all about myself or my loss. I'm not trying to capitalise on it by any means. I'm just wishing to share, and as any other podcaster do. One of the things I met with when people say, why, you know, when I say I've got a podcast, I guess now it'll be turning more to the response of, oh, you as well, because it's becoming very in vogue, but it's why? Why do you do it? And I would do it, but I just think, why would anyone care what I have to say? Well, yeah, and that's a discussion for another time, but that could be true of anything in life. Why bother doing anything? Like, who's going to care? I just do it. I'm doing this for the exact same reasons I would do any other of these podcasts, just to get it off my chest or to share in it and hope that it provides some sort of signpost for somebody else who might be experiencing the same thing. It's all about just shared experience, I guess. Page 15 anyway says, it is hard to have patience with people who say there is no death or death doesn't matter. There is death, and whatever is matters. And whatever happens has consequences, and it and they are irrevocable and irreversible. You might as well say that birth doesn't matter. I look up at the night sky. Is anything more certain than that in all those vast times and spaces? If I were allowed to search them, I should nowhere find her face, her voice, her touch. She died. She is dead. Is the word so difficult to learn? That's very stark, very cold, and just very truthful. I found it a massive annoyance when you see those trite, almost, I guess it's akin to an internet meme, where it might be a bit of reconditioned wood or something that they sell, and it's always got one of these little sayings on, or these little epithets, and it's always like, I'm not gone, I'm just in the other room. That's just not truthful. You've got to be honest about the thing, and it's insulting to the deceased. That's nothing to do with me or my feelings. My mother has died, and I think it does a great disservice to the pain she suffered to say things like that. I actually find it very, very insulting. I think one more thing from the book, and then I'll go into more personal territory and try to speak just from the heart. Have you marked this? What was this one? Yeah, can I honestly say that I believe she now is anything? The vast majority of the people I meet at work would certainly think she is not, though naturally they wouldn't press the point on me, not just now anyway. What do I really think? I have always been able to pray for the other dead, and still do, with some confidence, but when I try to pray for H, I halt. Bewilderment and amazement come over me. I have a ghastly sense of unreality, of speaking into a vacuum about a non-entity. The reason for the difference is only too plain. You never know how much you really believe anything until its truth or falsehood becomes a matter of life and death to you. It is easy to say you believe a rope to be strong and sound as long as you are merely using it to cord a box. But suppose you had to hang by that rope over a precipice. Wouldn't you then first discover how much you really trusted it? The same with people. Again, just a paragraph with a very simple metaphor there, but so wholly and devastatingly true of my experience anyway. I guess it's tantamount to the subjectivity of things like, my political leanings. If this is kind of going off on a tangent, but hopefully I'll explain it well. Questioning your value system, your belief system. It's easy to sit and have an opinion on something without the experiential, the knowledge of the actual thing. As Lewis is saying there, you can pray easily for the other dead, but now it's actually subjective to him and his loss. He's all too aware that it's complete nonsense, basically. And only when you're truly tested can you form a proper belief. I find that oftentimes when talking about, say, the more right-leaning tabloids, I guess, covering, say, a child murder, and it's all, they need to be, the pitchforks are out, and we need to, the death sentence should come back. And as a lefty, my reaction is, oh God, no, an eye for an eye leaves us all blind and blah, blah, blah. But it wouldn't be until, I mean, now I'm going to be a father, and now considering, say, my child came into harm, would my belief structure would likely very much change, because I am afforded the, you know, the experiential insight now. I'd have a child of my own, and it would be my experience that would inform that. So I find that very, it's just very true. It's a very truthful book, and it is of great comfort. I mean, it's very dark and deeply bleak, but like a lot of my, I guess, my music and my podcasts, it achieves what I'm setting out to do in those things, and that's just share, and hopefully I will have a similar, not that I'm trying to compare myself to you, I'm sure you understand, I'm not being like that. Anyway, yeah, it was a year ago tomorrow that my mother passed, and outside of Lewis, the main thing that sticks out to me in terms of comfort or solace was something an ex-partner actually said to me, who I no longer really speak to, but she lost her mother when she was, I guess, the age I'm at now. And I reached out to her because I felt like that would be somebody qualified to, if she would be so kind to offer some kind of consolatory, you know, words, and she was big enough to do that. She was very good, and her words on I can't say I would never forget, because there's nothing definite in this life, but I'm sure I would find it hard to expel the words from memory. She said grief is like standing with your back to the ocean. You know, 1 minute you're fine, you're at ease, you're calm, and then a wave will just crash down around you, unexpectedly. And that's how I found it. It comes in waves. I've been very up and down with it this year. I guess that the laziness hasn't really applied too much. It did initially. I didn't want to participate in the world. I didn't want to listen to what anybody had to say. I was just plainly disinterested, uninterested. And it was great to read Lewis describe it as just, you know, no one tells you about the laziness. He's telling me, and I felt better, you know, felt better about myself. I didn't feel so bad about being inert and incapable of, just completely disabled. I've been very, very active, and I don't know if that's the, you know, the age old concept of looking for a distraction purposefully or what. I mean, I've been dwelling on this a lot in terms of my psychological state, outside of not really thinking about grief too much lately. It hasn't really occurred to me. I'm sure it's there subliminally, as the whole wave metaphor suggests. It's always there underneath the surface, ready to coil up around you. But I've been very active. I don't know if I'm chasing down something as a means of, you know, acceptance, if it's an egotistical thing or a panicky thing or what, or if it is born of grief and just trying to find a way outside of myself. Who knows? But that's been my experience. All I can say is that over this last year, it has come and gone to a fashion that the loneliness, and it goes unchecked. I don't really realise until I reflect on it and get kind of contemplative about it all. Yeah, I was doing that for that month. Like, I spent a lot of time at my best friend's home. He's there with his parents, who've become surrogate parents to me. I always did that as a child. I'd enjoyed going over to the family homes of friends, because I came from a broken home. My mother left the house when I was still quite young and lived away down in North Yorkshire. And me and Dad, it took us a long time to develop any sort of strong bond or relationship for many, many reasons that I won't go into now. And used to kind of befuddle friends, like, why the hell do you want to sit in the sitting room when your parents wouldn't go into the room and play GoldenEye and, you know, put that cheat on that makes the heads all massive and shoot them? Doesn't that sound better than watching Question of Sport with me dad? I don't know if anyone still gets why I like that. There's something about the warmth of a family home where there's, I mean, as Lewis said there, that aspect of, if only they wouldn't talk to me, just to each other. Like, I love that. I can just sit around people, you know. I'd rather that most of the time they didn't talk. If it was just a few people in a family home, it's warm, everything's on the go, there's food cooking. That is a huge comfort to me. I've always felt like that, and especially in the last year. I've definitely sought that out willfully. Constantly, almost living with this best friend and his family. Going to work, and then, because fortunately I work in the same, my workplaces are nearby, just stopping off there and end up spending the night, you know, having me tea cooked for it. But then that feeds into, you know, the feelings of my, you know, I'm becoming dependent here. I'm a man of 29. I have actually owned my own house, which I pay a mortgage for, that's standing there completely uninhabited. It's funny that, because Lewis talks about his body being an empty house following his loss. Yeah, it's just a great displacement with me and the world, and the times when the grief really arises, and it is like a drunkenness or a blanket across the head, just a wanting to withdraw. You know, what's the point in trying to share these things that are already very hard to give words to? But anyway, when she did die, the night she died, on the 5th of December 2013, it was a very eerie day. I'd been to an appointment. I'd driven back up to Newcastle, as I often did. I'll be back and forth a lot, trying to balance both, you know, dual lives. It's a very tiring time. I don't tell you all this so you feel sorry for me, or do I? I went to a tattoo appointment, and I mean, it was obvious that morning. I woke up in the upstairs of Mum's flat, and it was the first morning. We had round the clock care for her, so nurses would sleep over downstairs with her and say to her, you know, making sure, you know, looking after a bag and a driver and so forth. And it was the first morning I wasn't awakened by her screams of agony. So I knew then that this was a different day. And she'd become, I'm not going to go right into it, the physiological aspect of things about her appearance, or, you know, the what she was depending on at that point and her state. And I won't go any more beyond than I hope that you, the listener, never have to see anyone you love, specifically your mother or father, in that kind of state. What I will say is that she had become very, I'm trying to find the words here. She was very confused, given the level of medication she was on. She was, is it what you call confabulating a lot? Just coming out with very bizarre things, as if, you know, very, and it's very alarming when that happens. I guess if you have experienced, maybe dementia is the only thing it can be likened to. She was clearly struggling with it. I remember one day, this was before, see, she'd returned home, by the way, we brought her home for the last days. There was one day I remember in hospital, I have a dog, a small dog called Clement, and my mother had never ever met Clement. You know, he lived up north with me. We had very separate lives. We had a very fragmented relationship at this point. And she said to me when I came to visit that she'd just taken Clement out for a walk, which obviously, aside from the fact that she's terminally ill and in isolation, in an isolated ward in a room in a hospital, the fact that she's down in North Yorkshire, you know, and she's never even met Clement, and the fact that I was with, you know, things like that, and that would put you in an awkward position of how do I respond to that. I very gently told her that wasn't the case. I didn't know I was on the spot what to do, but her face just dropped into that of a small girl, I guess, a child who was scared. You know, why is this in my head? Why do I think that happened? And that only worsened. So the mornings would be, the alarm clock would be her screams, and then you don't appreciate that, with her dying, that, well, I didn't. You just think it's bad enough that they're dying. What all you have to contend with really is offsetting the physical pain and just getting them through as best you can. That was my assumption. But what I never realised were the very trivial things, like that the main cause of my mother's pain was just pure discomfort. There was no way for us or any of the visiting care that came round three times during the day, or the overnight nurses, or indeed when we had to call out ambulances, because when we first took her home, we'd sit her down on a couch and we couldn't get her back out of the chair. She was so weak. None of us could just very, very plainly could get her comfortable either, you know, mainly in bed. She was so, so ravaged by the cancer. You could see the beveled ridges of her spine. Everything was exposed. She was. I'm going into the physical element then. I didn't want to do that because it's too horrific, really. But because of the frailty of her and the her exposed spine specifically, just getting her comfortable in bed. The one thing you can offer a dying person who's almost completely invalid is just a bed to lie in, to die with some dignity. That's the very least and also the very most you can offer. And when you can't even do that successfully, that was a very difficult thing to experience. So this day she woke up, well, sorry, I woke up, not via her, but just by, you know, my own actual alarm clock, and it clicked with me that this wasn't, something was wrong. And then when I went downstairs, I discovered that she was just unconscious. Now I wish I could remember what the last thing she said was. Even if it was just something she had, you know, struggled with and made up, some sort of nonsense. I have no idea what our last words were or what her last words were. I can't. I've laid awake at night trying to remember, fighting, forcing myself, but I can't. I just stood there this morning, and I was lost again. I was trying to be gentle, but I didn't know what to do. And my dad called from over my shoulder, imploring me just to say something to her, in a very panicked voice. And I just told her that I loved her and just to wait for me. I'd be right back. And I drove up the A1. And I don't know if it's, I don't necessarily believe in all this, but there was a certain portent to that day. There was overturned hulks of lorries that I passed. The rain was beating down. It was almost a storm. And I just knew. I mean, it's not, I don't really subscribe to all that kind of stuff, but it's hard. As I said before, your beliefs are formed chiefly through the experience, you know, life or death stuff. And I don't think anyone could tell me that day I didn't know that she was going to die. And then throughout the day I was getting a tattoo done, and I was every text I received I just imagined it would be to say she was gone. I came straight back and felt she was beckoning me, pleading with me to get back as fast as I could. I got there and I just had this, inside I had this strong compulsion to be alone with her. I needed to speak to her. Again, she was, you know, I could see unconscious and her breathing was very laboured. I asked my dad to leave the room eventually. I couldn't contend with this compulsion anymore. He left and we had, say, 5-10 minutes. I just told her how much I loved her, that I forgave her for everything, and I just said I'm sorry for how all this has turned out between us. And I kissed her forehead. Got up, my dad re-entered. I got up remembering that somebody, one of the staff at the hospital or whatever, one of the carers had said, you know, oh, still talk, they can still hear you, and maybe just play music. I was trying to be quite constructive about the time spent with her, you know, maybe I could play something and just sit and listen to the music with her, whatever that might mean, or however much we, you know, that might be something we could do together. And I turned to the CD rack to look at her stuff, and just, you know, knew that was it. And, you know, no sooner had I turned around and again, just watching her chest as I had been for weeks for the rise, and then just waiting for it not to deflate the lungs to, sure enough, she just stopped, and that was it. And I actually felt a lot of relief, a lot. I can remember that. It's obviously expected. We knew it was going to happen. It came a lot quicker than we thought. Granted, but it was a massive relief to me. Anyway, this is getting a bit too long. I might have to do another part, just to continue. I'm just going to end this one with a song I wrote about her. I will play that now. Yeah.